Okay, very good. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to bring to order the February 5th, 2013 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. Welcome to everyone. Thank you for being here, and I know some folks have traveled a considerable distance to testify today. We very much appreciate those efforts. I'm first going to open an organizational meeting, and our first order of business is the adoption of the committee rules. Those should be in your packet, and there are a couple, I believe, changes from what I think most of us are accustomed to. And Beth, if you would please cover that for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the rules that are in front of you do have a few changes, three. First of all, the references to dual leadership or the co-governance references have been removed. In Rule 16B, there has been a couple of words added. The words are of said measure. They've been added to require that the ideas that are contained in a minority report be raised during discussion of the underlying subject or measure. And then Rule 17 is entirely new, and that requires that with regard to a declaration of a conflict of interest in committee, that the member first announce the conflict prior to voting in the same way that you do on the floor, and then second, that you submit a written statement of the conflict to the committee assistant by 5 p.m. of the next business day after the committee vote. And except for those three that I've mentioned, the rules are identical to previous committee rules.
Very good. Thank you. Any discussion on the rules? Representative Krieger?
The new one requiring the filing of reasons for your conflict. What if someone didn't do that? What are the consequences of not doing that? In other words, I've declared my conflict here, but, you know, I've already done it. It's a matter of record. Why do I got to do it again? I ain't going to do it. So, what if we get someone with that type of an attitude? I don't know who that might be.
Well, Representative Krieger, we can remember not too many sessions ago when someone told us that he was going to vote and took a while to do that as well. So I think that this is one of those instances where we are honor-bound as members of the legislature to follow through with the rules and the requirements that are before this committee. At this point, I am not aware of the heavy hand of government and what it would do to any one of us individually.
And we should be working with our chair.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Representative Krieger. Additional questions or comments regarding the adoption of our committee rules? Seeing none, hearing none, the chair would recognize Representative McCoon.
Chair Witt, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 5th, 2013.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen moves adoption of the proposed committee rules dated February 5th, 2013. Discussion on her motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? Seeing none there, the rules stand adopted. Thank you very much, committee members. I appreciate that. Our next order of business in the organizational meeting is self-introductions. And for your assistance, we handed out a kind of a member introductions cheat sheet. And for those of you who haven't had an opportunity to think about what you would like to say, I will go first and give you some time to think about what you're going to say. And then we'll proceed down the line. I'm State Representative Brad Witt. I represent House District 31, which is Columbia County, Northern Washington County, those portions north of Highway 26, and a portion of Multnomah County along Highway 30 that passes Sobeys Island. My interest in agriculture and natural resources began as a young man. They couldn't keep me off of the river behind my house or out of the woods. I would be gone for hours as just a young kid. as a Boy Scout and something that was part of my life as a young man. We were taught conservation always meant the wise use of our natural resources. I don't think there has ever been a better approach to the both the protection and the use of some of our state's greatest riches and resources. I own a small 35-acre farm in Klatskanai. As many of you know, was a career-long, still am, union representative. I began that venture in the forest products industry and have served on the state boards of forestry, watershed enhancement, the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, and co-chaired the Bi-State Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership. One of my natural resource heroes is sitting in the back of the room, and that's Bill Clooning. And Bill has been a longtime member of the solid wood products industry, worked all of his life to provide a good living for himself and his family, and made it part of his lifelong career to help assure the same for others. Bill is not only an expert in the forest products industry, but I can assure you that if there is ever any issue regarding natural resources, he knows at least a little bit about it and probably a whole lot. A short little story. 4 years ago, he took myself and a friend to the Valley of the Giants to share with us truly a treasure, the state of Oregon. And one of the lessons that I learned there was that those people who work with natural resources probably have as great a respect and love for those resources as does anyone. A lifelong career in an extractive industry, and I can assure you that his love is unsurpassed for the forest and the trees. I'd also add, as an aside, when we were coming back down the hill from the Valley of the Giants, Bill, who is, unfortunately, Bill, you're no longer a young man, I'm calling it as I see it, had suffered a very, very, very severe injury a number of years ago. Many of us wondered whether he might have ever walked again. I watched him on logs that were 5 to 6 feet in diameter literally dance down the side of that hill. So I would have loved the opportunity to see him do that as a younger man. And I know that I enjoyed it and he enjoyed the day himself very much. What I think this committee could realistically accomplish to better serve our state, I would like to move public opinion to the point that we begin to obtain permission as a state entity to continue the very, very fine job that our state does in managing our natural resources and continue to be able to maintain that permission as well. With that, I'm going to turn to Representative Whitsitt and turn it over to our committee members.
Thank you. I'm Gail Whitsitt. I represent the southern half of Klamath and Lake counties all the way to the California border. I have a bachelor's and master's degrees in geology from Oregon State University, and I grew up on a large working ranch in Montana as a child. My husband and I, Senator Whitsitt, also own a ranch, a small ranch in Klamath County, where we have an equine breeding facility. One of my natural resource heroes would be my great-great-grandfather drove the first European cattle into the state of California from Virginia in the 1830s and established ranches in present-day Los Angeles County. And something that I would say that we need to do and can do is to better utilize our natural resources in the state. Ocean, timber, water, off-stream storage, and our mining resources. And this is to provide revenue for the state, for our public services, schools, police, and fire. So I'm very interested and very pleased to be on this committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Unger.
My name is Ben Unger, and I represent House District 29, which is the western part of Washington County. It's downtown Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove, and then the communities of Bearport and Roy. Unlike what many people think of when you think of Hillsborough, it doesn't include any intel jobs. It doesn't include any high-tech jobs, really. It's mostly it's the small-town part of Hillsborough, really, and it includes a lot of small businesses that serve the agricultural community surrounding those small cities. I grew up on a farm south of Cornelius, and getting to the next question here about where my interest in agriculture comes from, my dad still farms wheat, oats, grass seed, crimson and red clover, a little bit of field corn, too. And we've been farming on that land since 1906, so we just got our century farm designation a little bit ago. Anyone who's farming is a hero at this point, so I don't know if you want to pick just one, but if you're still doing that work, it's God's work, and I think it's really important to protect. The one thing that I'd like to see this committee do is to continue to find innovative ways for us as a legislature to invest in and support our agricultural rural economies to make sure that we're creating as many good jobs outside the UGB as we are inside the UGB.
Thank you. Representative Creed.
Well, my district is District 1, which is the South Coast. They, by the way, they do rate us by district, which is the South Coast. I have Curry, Douglas, actually 70% of Coos County. A lot of people don't know that. And then I got a little bit of Josephine County, which I have to drive 42 miles into California to get, or drive to I-5 and go down past Grants Pass to get. So there's really no way to get there, so it's been very difficult. Those communities, especially on the coast, you know, the coastal communities are involved in the commercial fishing, the sport fishing. As we learned the other day, Brookings received 51% of the Chinook landed last year. One port has a lot of bar crossings. That community also is about 70% retired. So they're very fixed income people, and a great number of veterans in that district also. Talking about natural resource heroes and those type of things is something I'll get to in a minute. But, you know, my background has been 28 years with the State Police Game Division Enforcement. And during that time, of course, I did commercial fish enforcement on the coast. So if you talk about commercial fish issues in this building, I don't think there's anyone now that knows what I know about the industry, the culture, the people, and the background, and what drives it, and probably what we need to do to help sustain it. I spent with Brad 6 years on the Board of Forestry, 5 on OWEB, 2 years on the American Tree Farm Executive Board, 2 years on the Forest Industries Council on Taxation in Washington, D.C., and then our tree farm was the National Tree Farm for the whole United States in 93. And I'm proud to say that this is the first year I did not do my own harvesting. I had Zubers and Sons come in and take 95 loads of logs off of 10 acres, which is a pretty good, you know, that was a nice, I never had a check over $100,000 before. But out of that, of course, that was just the one check. There's $55,000 in a tax account. So if we manage our private land, we can contribute to the capital gains, state capital gains, federal, the severance tax, the forest tax, and the property tax this year, and we'll also have the trees planted next week. So we've been involved in that. Been involved in, because of my background, hunting and fishing all my life. I killed my first deer at 6 years old right alongside the Gearhart Drive-In Theater in June. I didn't think anything about it back in those days. That was kind of the culture of the families that lived, you know, in our rural community. You kind of lived off the land. I'm very interested in this whole controversy, and I see a few people in here regarding hatchery fish and wild fish and all the rhetoric that goes on, and I hope to make some progress in that line with legislation this time through. And you talk about the heroes, and to my way of thinking, it's always been the husband and wife teams, the generational pass down of a piece of property, forest land. Commercial fishing industries have boats passed down, farms and ranches, and that culture that we have in our rural communities, which is hugely valuable. And I would also say that out of those type of families, out of those type of homes, the criminal element is much lower. They've learned a work ethic at a very young age. There are, you know, kids driving tractors are 8 and 10 on flat, good ground. I started my son on a D6 Cat when he was 12. Of course, he was 5'10", 212 pounds at 12 years old. So, you know, got somebody big, you might as well use him. His son, my grandson, is 6'4", 280 pounds, and he's 17, so I'm going to use the horsepower of the family to help on the ranch. But those rural communities, and you know, that's what was so sad for me to see what happened on the Columbia River with the commercial fishermen. A travesty. Manipulated by the governor. Now come out and say it. I don't care whether people like it or not. Go talk to Betsy Johnson. She's about to go through the ceiling. But anyway, the culture of those rural communities, I think, is something that we need to preserve in any way that we can. You talk about identifying some of the committees could do to realistically and do a better service of the state. I think accountability of us, accountability of the state agencies, I think is really important. We need to be working for things that are in the best interest of all the state. A good example of that was Speaker Kotek, and several members came down to Coos County the other day, looked at the rail line, the port, realizing that there's a huge potential for economic potential down there for jobs and get our kids back in school. I think that is extremely important. I believe it's also difficult for all of us who have a position on something not to get married to the agenda of a special interest group without really taking into consideration the consequences that other people are going to suffer as a result of it.
Thank you very much, Representative McCune.
Thank you. Well, first of all, it's a great honor to be on this committee. My name's Kattie McEwen. I was born and raised in Coos Bay. And Wayne, I'm very well aware that you now cover 70% of Coos County. It was a little tough when they carved out Charleston and gave it to you because it's 5 miles from my house. But the redistricting changed just a little bit, and I'm happy to begin to share. As a Coos County girl, my family came to Coos County in two different ways. My mother's side of the family came at the turn of the century, the prior century, from Sweden, and were dairy farmers making their way. They had 9 children born on a farm in Sweden, and only one could stay and run the farm, so everybody immigrated to the United States. My grandfather on my father's side came to Coos Bay early in the century also to start a new life, and he milled spruce logs from the forest around the bay and rafted them down the bay to a mill on the shores of North Bend and built a little mill that veneered spruce logs and built a wire frame and had a very niche industry, made box tops for orange crates and shipped them by rail car down to the orange growers in Southern California for about 20 years. So that's how my family began their roots in Coos Bay. My mom at age 8 years old in 1928 started fishing down on the Rogue River with her father. She's now 92 and still throws a beautiful fly and has a place down at Agnes where we've spent a great deal of our time as family. It's kind of where our family gathers when we're doing recreational time and family time. So the fishing aspect of the natural resource-based economy that we have on the South Coast has been very important to our family for a long time on the recreational side. I have also grown up, we're hunters in my family. My husband and I, we raised our kids on elk and venison and moose and caribou and fish and all of those things that this wonderful, abundant natural resource base of this state has provided. And so that's something that I've been involved in for a very long time and have great respect for. Also ducks and pheasant and chucker and all those other things that just fry up great in a frying pan. Senator, Representative Krieger, as a port commissioner too, I've been involved with the fishing community in Coos Bay and the crabbing industry and all of those things that come across our docks at the port of Coos Bay down in Charleston. So I've seen that industry from the side of a commissioner that's very involved in making sure that the ice dock's working and that the docks are in good repair and that we have a safe harbor for those vessels that are coming in when the seas get rough and taking care of an industry that's very important to the economic vitality of our community. I have a number of heroes. I started out my college career at the University of Oregon, took a botany class, kind of changed the way I viewed the world and transferred to Oregon State and was an ag major. I was a horticulture major at Oregon State for 2 years. Finished up there, wasn't able ever to put that into practice, but it's something that I started off on a path of being very interested in. So it's another reason that this committee I find fascinating. Heroes, I've got a couple, and one is a gentleman in Coos Bay. His name is Boyd Arnett. He's a bit of a legend down in our part of the world. He started out as a logger by trade. He's now 92 years old and still actively cruising timber, managing, working with a timber company that as Chair Witt said, If you want to find somebody that's a great steward of our resources, a lot of times it's the guys that are out working out there every single day who see 20 years and 30 years and 40 years and 50 years into the future as to how they can grow things well and create a sustainable industry. And Boyd's somebody I've known for a long time and that I have great respect for and hope to learn more from as time goes on now that I'm on this committee when I'm back in my district. I also want to bring up just one more thing, and Chair Witt, it has to do with conversations that you and I have had over the last couple of weeks as we prepared for my new service. And as a freshman, boy, I'm here just trying to suck things in, and I'm listening and learning and trying to find my way. But one of the things that you brought up for me was, as this session unfolds, the importance of viewing this committee work from three perspectives, and it's looking at things from how it impacts the economics of the state and the regions and the districts that we all come from, how it affects the environment. We all live here. We want to live in a world that's clean and looking to the future to make sure that our children and our grandchildren have the beautiful benefits of this state and the natural resources available to them that we are taking advantage of now and the social aspects of the decisions that we make. So I really appreciate your forethought in how you want to approach this committee work, and I've appreciated the conversations that we've had. I'm not sure it rises you to hero status, but I think I'm being careful. But it truly did kind of give me a lot to think about as I'm brand new here and here to listen and learn. But I think if we can keep those things in mind with a balanced approach to how we view what's coming towards us, I think it will serve us all very well. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Representative, and I've enjoyed our opportunity to chat as well. With that, our committee's former chair, Representative Klein.
We're not going to make Beth talk about her ag heroes. So I'm Brian Klein. My district is right here. You're sitting in it. It's in urban Salem, which doesn't explain why I've been on the Ag Committee for three terms now very well, except that my constituents are public employees who, if there's no economy in rural Oregon, they get laid off. So it's important that they have jobs related to a healthy rest of the state. My main interest, of course, comes from marrying into a longtime orcharding family in the Hood River Valley, and my wife and I, along with her sister, her mom, and her cousin still own and operate a 80-acre commercial fruit orchard that produces 2 million plus pounds of pears and several hundred thousand pounds of cherries per year now. And I would say my ag hero is certainly her dad. He's the one who taught me what I know now about running an orchard. And he was interned during World War II, even though he was born on that orchard and had never been to Japan or anything else. His parents had immigrated from Japan, you know, quite 40 or 50 years before that. And so he and his family, after the internment camps, came back. Not all Japanese Americans did that, but they came back and basically had to retame a wild orchard that had been overgrown now for 4 years at that point. And then he, you know, he died on his orchard in 2004 with his daughters and his wife right next to him, and he loved that place dearly. So he would definitely be on the ag side. And then in the other sort of part of our committee's jurisdiction, I grew up in Coos Bay too, was born there and raised there, and my entire family worked at Weyerhaeuser at one point or another. And my dad instilled in me a love of hunting and fishing that, you know, still to this day, every year I go hunting with him. You know, there's many things that I've passed on in order to make sure I still get, you never know how many more years you're going to have left hunting with your dad. And so I passed on a lot of things to be able to still do that every fall with him. And you'll never see him around here, because that would mean leaving the Umpqua River, where he fishes about 8 hours every single day. I just saw pictures yesterday on Facebook of these giant steelhead they're catching right now, sort of rubbing it in, and my brother was down there too, and reminding me that while I'm here, they're catching fish. So, anyway, the realistic thing that I think this committee could do would be to, I think, just like seizing all federal lands and managing them better. It's a realistic goal. It's very realistic. That's about all I have to offer.
Thank you very much, Representative Reardon.
Well, I don't know that I want to follow that, but I'm Representative Reardon, and I'm House District 48, which is out of East Portland, in northern Clackamas County, and we have no forest and we have no agriculture. Having said that, Clackamas County is heavily into agriculture. I think I've seen either third or fourth largest agricultural producer in the state, so definitely support the efforts of the people in my district for that reason. I'll give a little background, because this was kind of a pop quiz here. As a former classroom teacher, I just hate pop quizzes. Never did it to my students. I think background, because it's important to understand people's values and where they're from. I grew up in small town Kelso, Washington. Spent a lot of time on my grandfather's farm. He was kind of getting older and getting out of the farming business, but still spent a little time making the hay, working with the cattle. We butchered our own beef, and realizing that it took me a while to figure this out. My grandparents didn't know that they were poor. I mean, they really had a shoddy house. When I think back about it, the floor tile was worn out, and you could kind of see cracks around the windows. But we ate so well. My grandmother canned everything. They had their own garden. They're beef cattle. So they were able to live very well and somewhat humbly, but they did well. My great grandfather was a logger around the turn of the early 1900s, late 1800s, in the area north of Kelso, Castle Rock area on the Cowlitz River. And so lots of pictures, lots of stories about, their life. And they pretty much did they didn't have too many environmental restrictions in those days. And so they pretty much whacked down everything in the forest. Interesting time, economically they had challenges. My grandfather was reported to have been a very rich man three times. Unfortunately, I've always thought that he died on the down cycle, and none of his wealth was passed on to me. So I'm kind of sorry about that. So I think that, you know, a combination of, you know, farming, my brother still has a farm out in Clatskanie. We have family in Northern California that are rice farmers. So kind of that much of a connection, and I think, if anything, just an appreciation for the values of farmers and what they do and how hard they work. They are able to enjoy the land. They use the land, make their livings. But every one farmer I've known and the loggers that I've known have also cared deeply about protecting the land. And I think that that's kind of the perspective that I would bring to the table here, even though I'm probably mostly city guy. So things to do. As I've come into this, I think the things I picked up on, the greatest concern and that I want to learn more about is probably, are we able to govern our water policy well enough? Again, this is just first impressions, but it seemed like there are just a lot of governing agencies that have something to do with water. And I'm just curious about that. I'd like to know more about that. How effectively can we do that when we know that we're going to be dealing with issues around climate change? You know, can we make the decisions that we need to deal with that? We know that we're going to have greater needs for water. How do we deal with that? And how can we govern it? How can we have the conversations we need? And so I'll be looking carefully at that. Also very concerned about making sure that we can have a reasonable, sustainable level of harvest from our forest. I think I could share that. I've talked to people in our counties. They need the revenue badly. Understand that. And so how do we do that? Make sure, again, we're protecting the forest but using them in a way that that makes sense and sustainable. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. I am eager to learn more, and I look forward to working with the rest of you.
Thank you very much, Representative Reardon. I am listening to the committee members' statements. I'm struck by the connections that each and every one of us has to agriculture and natural resources. As we go forward for the next 5 months in crafting public policy, I think the passion that is palpable here for those resources will be one of the best guides that we have. With that, I thank you, committee members, for sharing your background with us. I'm going to close the organizational meeting. And I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of committee measures. We have two LC drafts for consideration as introduction of committee measures. I want to underscore the fact that as we entertain the introduction as committee measures, this would not in any way mean that you would be favorably disposed or opposed to the measure, but only that they be introduced as committee bills. We have two of them, LC 2108, which is, deals with unlawful tethering of animals, and LC 2890, which deals with commodity commissions. And with that, I would ask our committee administrator, Ms. Petrino, to give us a brief background about them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LC 2108, as the chair stated, would specify that a person commits the crime of animal neglect in the first degree if that person tethers a domestic animal and the tethering results in serious injury or death to the animal. The other LC 2890 is, as I understand it, a correction that needs to be made to the Commodity Commission statutes in order to adjust the number and geographic representation of the commissioners.
Thank you very much. Is there any discussion or commentary on either of the LCs? Representative Woodsett?
Yes, I'd just like to make a comment that in Section B on on 2108, they describe that the tether cannot be less than 15 feet in length, and so I am assuming this is not for horses, because you would not tether a horse on a length of rope greater than 15 feet, or you would have a disaster. So I assume this is only for dogs.
I think that actually that would be an issue that we can get into as we discuss the bill, and I think you bring up a very valid point. Thank you. The bill does speak, or the LC draft does speak to the presence of a human being too is part of the consideration of the tethering length. Additional questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative McCown?
Chair Whitt, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 2108, dated January 29th, 2013, and LC 2890, dated January 8th, 2013.
Thank you very much. Representative McCown moves that LC 2108, dated 1/29/13, and LC 2890, dated 1/8/13, be introduced as committee bills. Discussions on that motion? Is there any opposition to the introduction of these bills? Seeing or hearing none, they stand adopted as committee bills. Thank you very much, members. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on the introduction of committee measures and open our informational meeting. And with that, it is my distinct pleasure to be able to introduce to you Jim Brown. Jim is our state's former state forester from 1986 through 2003. Almost 13 years of service as our state forester. And I would ask you to consider how many individuals you know in state service that have served at the head of a state organization, and particularly one that has had the challenges of resource management that the Department of Forestry has had. Jim went on to become Governor Kulongowski's Natural Resource Policy Director in 2003 and served for 2 years in that position. During that time, he chaired the Governor's Natural Resources Cabinet, where he provided leadership to 14 natural resource agencies. Jim earned his way through the ranks, first as a forester trainee in Coos Bay in 1960. And it must have been a career and a career path that attracted him. And he served in virtually every other rung of the Department of Forestry's ladder in the ensuing years. He is a fellow of the Society of American Foresters and has served as the Western Rep, Treasurer, Vice President, and President of the National Association of State Foresters. He currently serves on the World Forestry Center Board and is a member of the National Commission on Science for Sustainable Forestry. And the perfect segue for why we asked him to be here today to help us to better understand the principles of sustainability. Jim is internationally recognized as an expert on that topic, and I want our committee to use the concept of sustainability, hopefully, for three key purposes. One is a benchmark for what constitutes good public policy vis-a-vis ag and natural resources. Two, for us to be able to use this concept to begin moving the management and use of our state's natural resources from what is all too common, just say no today, to yes. And last but not least, how do we obtain and ultimately maintain the public's permission to do so? With that, Jim Brown, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity. The chair has asked me to kind of give you kind of a deep background on where the concept of sustainability came from. And I'm going to do that through some PowerPoint slides. And then there's some slides, I think these were all handed out to you in advance, that I think you can use as a tool As you have conversations around the bills and try to frame public policy for the state, in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, the United Nations was worried about health issues, appointed a number of commissions to look at that. As they moved into the late 70s, early 80s, global environmental issues became of concern, and they appointed a commission that was chaired by a lady that was the Prime Minister of Norway, and her last name was Brundtland. That commission met for several years and in the end produced a book called Our Common Future. The jargon term for that report is called the Brundtland Commission. And I think significantly in the prelude to the work, she points out that, you know, the environment doesn't exist just in and by itself, separate from human interactions and ambitions. It's all linked together. That the environment is where we all live, and development is what we all do in attempting to improve our lot in life. And it was from this report that the contemporary terms sustainability, socially, economically, and environmentally came about. The UN then, following that report, had a conference in Rio in 1992 called UN Conference on the Environment and Development. To kind of further the work that the Brundtland Commission had done, and they and they just kind of one more thought she had there as well. So at the Rio conference, forestry turned out to be a very large part of that meeting, and something like 120 countries in the world committed to the principles, a set of principles around the concept of sustainable forestry. Following that meeting, the staff that was involved in that kind of looked at each other and said, well, that's great that we all agreed to the concept of our set of principles around sustainable forestry. We wouldn't know it if we saw it. So the world divided into a set of caucuses on geographic and forest types. So the United States and other countries that had temperate and boreal forests in both the northern and southern hemisphere met in Montreal. That caucus became known as the Montreal Process. The European countries first met in Helsinki. That became known as the Helsinki Process. And their goal was to kind of sit down and figure out how would we know sustainable forestry if we saw it. They began by using sticky notes, hung them on the wall, and they had representatives from the forest products industry, the NGOs, the different countries that were involved, and they plastered the wall with these notes, and in the end, they synthesized the Montreal process, as did the others. There were, in the end, seven processes around the world. Synthesized them into a framework that revolved around a set of inventory points. They were called indicators, but they're really inventory points of what the forest looked like as a way to evaluate how well an individual country was doing in terms of meeting its goals for sustainable forestry. So the concept is that sustainability is not nirvana. It's not a point on the wall. It's a conversation. And they left it to each country to figure out what that conversation would look like based on the data points that had been selected. In the Montreal process, they divide those 67 data points, disaggregated themselves into these blue bubble areas. And then behind each of these green bubbles are probably three to four inventory points. So like in biodiversity, they got three inventory points on ecosystem diversity, species diversity, and genetic diversity. Productive capacity, forest land, growing stock, and harvest and sustainability each have about three inventory points and so forth. Now, at first glance, this is kind of a mind-blowing chart. But when you stare at it for a while, you begin to understand that
if you're going to have economic and social benefits from the forest, you have to have productive capacity. You've got to have a land base. You've got to have growing stock. You've got to have trees on the land and harvest and sustainability, which in turn creates social and economic benefits. Likewise, by having forest land and trees on it, that provides the best water quality of any place in the United States. It provides the best biodiversity of any working landscape. It is a major carbon sink for carbon. So the point of the chart is sustainability is an and discussion. It's how do we use the forest to derive this suite of benefits over time and across the landscape, across different ownerships. Now, the reason that the Forestry Department got interested in this was in 1991, there was a bill, Senate Bill 1125, that was introduced at the request of the forest products industry to address some public concerns about forest practices. And during that bill discussion, there became a huge debate, fist fight almost, on the impact that forestry did or did not have on fisheries. And particularly the Senate committee, Senator Joyce Cohen, became very frustrated with that debate and insisted that into this bill go a section that the Forestry Department would evaluate cumulative effects of forest practices on our natural resources. At the time, cumulative effects was a buzzword, much like biodiversity is today. The section of the bill was written. She didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what it meant. Some other folks that helped write that section, they really didn't know what it meant. We contracted with Oregon State University to help us understand the notion of cumulative effects. We got back a fairly esoteric a report. And in the end, what we realized is we had no candle. We had no measures against which to judge cumulative effects. So we in the end adopted the 67 inventory points around the Montreal process as the way to evaluate Oregon's forest resource values. And we did that because it was internationally accepted. If we had ginned up our own inventory points, we would have been in an argument forever about whether it was the right inventory points or not. So we then set about collecting the information around those 67 inventory points, used a citizens advisory committee to help us do that. From that, had a major work conference at Oregon State University where we had about 500 people come, and in the end produced a report that evaluated forestry and its impact on other resources. From that, the Board of Forestry then took that information and created a policy document that they called the Forestry Program for Oregon that laid out their vision for forestry in the state on all lands, federal, private, and state. When I moved into the governor's office, the agreement I had with Governor Kulongoski at the time, his goal was to help the natural resource agencies understand they were not just environmental agencies, that they had a responsibility to contribute towards the economics of the state. And so we had each of the state agencies write a business plan, as we called it, that talked about how they were going to contribute to the social, economic, and environmental values of the state rather than just the environment. From that, we combed out a set of issues that we thought were of interest to the governor's office as well as to the agencies, and then put together this framework modified on the Montreal process. And you can see the similar type of diagram here. And again, it's the and piece of this, that working landscapes produce healthy ecosystems, which in turn provide social, economic, and environmental benefits.
and that you need an institutional infrastructure set of framework around which to make this model work. We then took that, and this is a truncated version of the longer sheet that you have in your packet. But it was really, again, we tried to lay out in the governor's office a mission, vision, goal, set of goals. What were the areas that we were interested in? The agencies had these action plans that we'd asked them to develop on how to address these sets of issues. And my reason for showing you this is my experience is that the concept, again, the concept of sustainability, socially, economically, environmentally, allows you to have this conversation of how well is our institutional infrastructure that we have set in place through the statutes and administrative rule processes we have in this state, how well do they help or hinder in working landscapes that produce healthy ecosystems and provide the social economic benefits that we all want. So in summary, the concepts of sustainability is really, it's a useful tool around which to have a public debate from which you're in turn trying to find a public interest on whatever subject you're trying to do. It's not, again, it's not nirvana. It's a conversation around which you find a public interest. So I'll stop there, and I would guess that had probably stirred some questions.
Thank you very, very much, Jim. We have a limited amount of time for questions and comments, and I would like to open it up briefly for that purpose. Representative Krieger, you're looking at me like you have something to say.
Well, you were there, and when I was on the board with Representative Witt, we were doing the Northwest Forest Plan for the Tillamook and Clatsop, and Dr. Sessions came in, and I can remember Dick, I can't remember his last name on the board.
Baldwin?
Baldwin. We were sitting there looking at the statistics, and it was made up of a program that forecast growth and all that, and when we got all done, it was off nearly 50% or some darn. It was a terrible number, and I told him at the time, I can get two lagers, a case of beer, drink it, and come out, I can guess closer than that. And of course, he didn't like to hear that, but to have confidence in some of these projections, do we have any better tools than a computer model? How do you compare that to out on the ground, actual foresters doing the work and telling us what's there and what the size? I realize you can model a lot of that, but when it was that far off, it lacked confidence. And then at the same time we were doing that, I think someone from the multidisciplinary independent science team came in, and we were talking about increasing buffer strips, and I asked for the science, and that was in 2000 or 99 or 2000. Supposedly it existed. No one ever produced it because it didn't exist. And when things like that happen, then my confidence in that independent science team, boom, gone. Being able to look at modeling, it's got to be closer than 50%. So the board makes policy decisions that go into administrative rules that govern the forest. And I'm not certain the forest is always going to benefit by it, and we're not utilizing the potential of the forest is what I'm saying, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I'm not sure I know how to respond. You're correct in terms of the modeling that was done. But understand, this is not a model. This is a framework of discussion. Around which, in the case of forestry, there were some data points to help you evaluate that. You're right. In that instance, the modeling was significantly in error for reasons. For at the time, we didn't understand that. Also, our inventory data at that time was a lot poorer than we had come to realize. Later. The board adopted that plan with the idea of adaptive management. As we learned more, discovered errors like that, they'd go back and they'd fix that. That's politically has been more difficult, I think, than anybody realized at the time. I think the agency is on the pathway now to reevaluate that, and you know, is on I think on track to make the necessary adjustments as it relates specifically to the issue that you raise.
Additional questions or comments? Representative Woodsit.
I was wondering if you have any idea or estimate of the loss of revenue to the state of Oregon that our present forest policies have resulted in.
Well, I would say I don't have anything specific. I would say in a general sense, particularly the federal forest policies, it's been significant adverse impact. And you can pretty easily see that by what's happened to the economy, particularly in eastern Oregon, but particularly in southern Oregon as well. I think that was brought up by one of the members, the federal land policies. I think that is a significant issue. It's I'm not quite sure how at the state level you can get at that other than through, if you will, politics at the national level. Several other states, Utah, Arizona particularly, are trying to address that issue. Governor Kitzhaber has a work group behind the scenes working on the BLM land issue. Now, whether they're able to move that to any sort of conclusion and action, I think that's difficult. That particular issue comes up about every 6 or 7 years, and we kind of go around the barn on it and end up back in the same place where we've been. My personal bias has long been that other states that came into the United States after Oregon and Washington, particularly the southwestern part of the United States, they were given 4 sections per township instead of the 2 that we got. We have to go back and argue for 4. Give us our other 4. That'd be pretty close to equivalent to all the BLM lands in western Oregon. That probably isn't going to fly any better than any other idea, but I still think it's a useful concept. I think that opportunity for the feds to step up and begin to recognize that retain the values they think that they're trying to steward, they're going to have a level of active management to do that. They just can't let them sit there. And you're beginning to see some of that in the Deschutes National Forest. There's a fair amount of harvesting that's going on to remove insect and disease infested trees and get those stands into a healthy state. But it's got to be on a much broader scale, not just in this state, but you know, across a much bigger landscape.
Committee members, I'd like to conclude with sharing, fast-forwarding for you, 3 years of experience that I had with Jim Brown, and having heard the three-legged stool story probably 20 times, and you know, I could repeat it in my sleep, and I knew that if we shorted one leg of that stool or two, that stool would tip over, and then all of a sudden, one day, I realized that regardless of how we come to the table, whichever leg or legs we think individually are most important to us, it behooves us, it is absolutely critical, it is essential and necessary that we do not get to sustain a level stool unless and until we assure the sustainability of the other two legs. And with that, Jim, thank you so very, very
Thanks
much.
For having me.
I know you're a bit under the weather, and I wish you the best of luck with it. It's a miserable cold.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so
Thanks
much.
For having
me. Committee members, as we move forward now with our panels, I'm going to ask you to hold your questions. The intent will be for our panel members to demonstrate to us and the rest of the state of Oregon just how important their particular enterprises are to our state and to the furtherance of sustainability. And with that, our first panel, I'm going to call up, please, Doug Decker, State Forester, Mayor Diane Pohl of Clatskanie, and Christina McNitt from the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Would you please come forward?
Do you want the
morning.
Good morning.
And if you would please give self-introductions and proceed. We handed out earlier a little cheat sheet to help guide your comments so that we can get through this as expeditiously as possible. And thank you all so very much for being here.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester and Director of the Department of Forestry. Thanks for sharing your stories and your backgrounds this morning. It's a privilege to hear that. It's a privilege to follow my friend Jim Brown as well, former State Forester. So, I think it's great that you started out the session with a good roundtable and a good chance to get these topics up on the table here to provide some context. I look forward to working with you and to responding to you here in this room as well as one-on-one, to responding to your questions and ideas. I'm always available to you, and as are members of my team. Our Deputy State Forester, Paul Bell, is here in the back of the room. Paul might raise his hand so you could recognize Paul. You'll be seeing him and me quite a bit in the next several months. We're a resource for you for information about our 30 million acres of forests in Oregon as well as our agency's related businesses. I've served as State Forester for the last 2 years and have worked closely with both of our last two State Foresters, Jim Brown and Marvin Brown. I'm a 25-year veteran of the agency, have worked about half-time in the field, half-time here in Salem. I have worked on fires. I've been closely engaged with our State Forest Program. I have worked closely with our Board of Forestry, including when Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, served on our board. With some of you and your predecessors here in the Capitol. A key principle for me is maintaining strong working relationships with our stakeholders and our partners, and I really consider it to be a privilege to be one of 12 State Foresters in the last century. We are one of Oregon's oldest state agencies. We celebrated our centennial 2 years ago, and I believe we're known as a can-do organization, which is a point of pride for all of us. You asked me to speak to the social, economic, and environmental contributions to Oregon in terms of the scope of our agency and our forests, and our three main businesses are prevention and controlling wildfire, regulating natural resource protection on private forest lands through the Oregon Forest Practices Act, and providing stewardship of our state-owned forests. And I want to touch on each of those three different businesses briefly here. Protection from fire is our top priority. We are Oregon's largest fire department. We protect 16 million acres of private, state, and some federal lands from fire. The issues that we face in that fire business are complex, ranging from the administrative side, having to do with creating and maintaining an equitable funding base for large fire costs, to the tactical side of fighting fire in a complicated environment of different land ownership patterns, different objectives, as well as in forest conditions that are where we've seen a real hazardous buildup of forest fuels that has made them ready to burn. We protect about a $60 billion asset in terms of that 16 million acres. Human health, public safety, jobs, community, economic health, forest health, water quality, and many more factors hinge on our ability to be effective in our job of fire protection. About 40% of our agency's budget and about almost 400 of our FTEs are focused in the area of fire. And basically all of us at the Department of Forestry have on our position description, we're part of the fire militia. So even if you're not in a fire job, when the bell rings, you need to be able to respond and be playing a role in our fire business. So natural resource protections on non-federal land, we administer the Oregon Forest Practices Act. It's our second major program. We work closely with private landowners to provide education and enforcement of the Forest Practices Act. Covers all aspects of forest management, operations from harvest to reforestation to road building. The rules and protections that are in the Forest Practices Act provide the regulatory backbone for the practice of forestry on private lands, assures the public that there are standards for natural resource protection. We've been in the process of rebuilding our private forest program over the last year, and about 13% of our overall budget, about 97 FTEs, are focused in that area. You asked me, how can you serve these interests? You're doing it. Chair Witt has given me the 1 minute sign, so I won't focus on state forests, but I know we'll be talking about that as I come back before you. I think inviting all of us here to the table today is very helpful. I encourage you to stay connected with the physical landscape. One of the things that I believe is that it's very important to understand the ramifications of policy decisions on the ground, and I've appreciated the earlier comments about your personal connections. I think that's very important. For us, our top priority in this coming session is the Wildfire Protection Act. We'll have a chance to talk some more about that. My personal goal in the session is for you to look at us as a resource for you, my team, to talk about our forests and our business, and I look forward to getting to know you one-on-one as well as here in the committee room. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Doug. I'd like to turn it over to Mayor Pohl, who I don't think any one of us will find a bigger advocate for the wise use of our state's natural resources. And Mayor Pohl is uniquely positioned in that her city owns its own timber and is able to harvest that on a sustainable basis. Welcome, Diane. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair Witt and committee. Thank you for having me. I am Diane Pohl. I was just sworn into my fourth term as mayor of Clatskanie. I'm an Oregon girl. Grew up in Southern Oregon, Klamath Falls and Medford. Spent my youth fishing and camping with my dad. My grandparents homesteaded in Canby, Oregon, and my great grandparents and spent all of their life in agriculture. To tell the story of Clatskanie, our community was built on agriculture, timber, and logging from the beginning in the 1800s. The city is the closest government to the people, and therefore it's our job to provide the most basic services, namely clean water, sewer projects, and public safety. In the case of our city, we have one more stewardship, and that is our timberland. Over the years, through land donations from prominent logging timber family and other procurements, we have ownership of 1,200 acres of timber. At the beginning, the city council opted to put funds from harvesting the timber into a reserve account, using only the interest to fund capital improvement projects and grants for youth activities. This has carried forward through many conservative city councils for many years. When the interest rate was 6% and 7%, we would have up to $190,000 per year for improvements to our city structures, namely water and sewer. This timber fund was put aside specifically for water and sewer infrastructure, not for general fund. It does not go into the general fund. When a sewer upgrade was needed some years ago, and it was well over $200,000, rather than taking out a loan, we opted to borrow from ourselves. We paid it back at a low rate of interest, and the city continues to be debt-free. It's very difficult for small rural cities to get grants for water and sewer infrastructure. It's very difficult. And so they end up getting these loans, and the interest is very hard sometimes for these small rural cities to handle. So we have about, due to our timber harvest, about $3 million in this fund that we have, we can use the interest from, we can borrow from, and that has allowed us to be able to accomplish having moderate water sewer rates and no loans. We hire a forester. This forester helps us with thinning, brush control, and maintenance of roads for fire purposes. Our stand of timber is carefully managed for optimum safety and growth. We have a stand of timber approximately 50 years old that needs to be harvested, and we've delayed this harvest because due to state law, we can only sell in domestic markets, not foreign markets. And the domestic market has been severely depressed. However, foreign markets have held and even increased their price. And I don't feel that it's fair and equitable to our citizens to have to sell to a depressed market. And it is my hope the legislature might consider legislation that would allow us to sell this timber at the best price, regardless of market status, to provide the maximum benefit to our cities and taxpayers. And I would just say also that newly planted trees gobble carbons. If we're worried about carbon and we're worried about our environment, to harvest these trees and replant with small trees seems to be a way to help our environment. And I want to thank you for allowing me to share my city's experience of using and being good stewards of renewable resources for the security of our city and community. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mayor Pohl. Christina, good morning.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I represent the Oregon Forest Industries Council. A lot of new faces on this committee and old friends as well. Since I last testified in front of you, Ray Wilkerson at OFIC has retired, and I have been privileged enough to fill his position as president of Oregon Forest Industries Council. And I wanted to introduce you today to our new general counsel and director of government affairs, Heath Curtis. Heath comes from Stoll Reeves. He's a six-year associate in their land use and natural resource practice area, and I anticipate that you'll be seeing a lot of him and probably of me as well. The Oregon Forest Industries Council is a trade association that represents the larger forest landowners in the state of Oregon, as well as the forest products manufacturing-related firms. And our membership includes multi-generational families, as well as REITs and TIMOs. And some of these companies are vertically integrated and include manufacturing portions. Some own just timberland, and some own manufacturing plants. And on the face of it, that may seem like a really diverse membership with disconnected interests. But really, that's not the case, because the value proposition of the forest land ownership really is vested in the infrastructure of communities to be able to process that asset. I wanted to expand a little bit more on Oregon's forest land base from State Forester Doug Decker to give you some perspective that our state is large. It's about 63 million acres, of which half is forest land. 1 minute. That was quick. So I will just summarize and say, from an economic standpoint, Oregon remains the number one producer of plywood and softwood lumber in the country, and statewide the forest sector accounts for 1 in 20 jobs. We generate $12.7 billion in direct economic impact and or output, and we look forward to working with this committee on concrete ways to help us enhance that, support rural economies, and the social impacts that those jobs bring.
Thank you very, very much, Christina, and we look forward to hearing more from your organization here in the intervening days. Thank you all very, very much. I'd like to call up now, please, Dave Barrows, Gil Riddell, and Roger Beyer. And as old saws, so to speak, I would ask, gentlemen, if you could please limit your statements to 3 minutes so that I can get through my cast of thousands today. Otherwise, I'm going to get killed. And we'll use reminders here as we proceed.
Fair enough. You want us to go on the order?
Sure, that'd be
okay.
Fine.
Dave Barrows, representing the Association of ONC Counties. It's been my privilege to represent them for 44 years. A few basic facts. Number one, the ONC counties are all in Oregon. People are very confused. Not any of you, but there are people who are confused. Think that you represent the Oregon and California counties? No. 18 counties, all but one in the west side, Oregon, Klamath being the only east side county that receives ONC receipts. Most of these lands are managed by the BLM, and Jim Brown talked about that. When he says the BLM, he's basically talking about ONC. Forest Service manages a little. These are great, probably the best federal timberlands in the country. Low elevation and all. 2 million acres, close to 60 billion board feet of standing timber. Much more favorable revenue distribution than counties get from Forest Service lands. Forest Service lands provide 25% of the receipts come to the counties through the state, and they are divided in only two ways, roads and schools. And the state legislature makes that call. You've decided 75% roads, 25% schools. but only of 25% of the take. ONC, 50% of the take, and that money goes right directly into the county's general fund. And Southwest Oregon counties are highly dependent on it, and thus the crisis that you're all familiar with. The cut on both Forest Service and BLM and lands has dropped to a small fraction of what it used to be. Mr. Brown referred to that. In the last major ONC developed forest management plan, the allowable cut was $1,127,000,000 board feet. We've had a 90% reduction. Same kind of a reduction on the Forest Service lands. And let me show you a little chart that starts in the fourth quarter of 86 and comes through the fourth quarter of 2011. And these are the harvest levels. This one's the Forest Service. This is the ONC. And this number up here is above $1.5 billion. And now you see it's bumping along at about $200 million on the average. One year since the Northwest Forest Plan was put into effect, 14 million board feet were put into the process. We need a permanent solution. The governor's been working on this. Three congressmen have been working on it. It's great. Every person in Oregon has a huge stake at the outcome of this current tragedy. Portland is already unhappy that school money that they think should be theirs is being shipped to southern Oregon school districts. If the environmental extremists prevail and prevent any permanent solution to the ONC crisis from occurring, the northern counties in the state will be shipping millions and millions of dollars south. Cannot stress that highly enough. If we don't get a permanent solution, because the environmentalists, just extremists, not all environmental groups, say no, we are going to have millions going south, or we're going to have people strapping on six guns on their hips from Linn County south, and we will see a reoccurrence of the Wild Wild West. Now, this may sound pretty dramatic or far-fetched, but it's already started. And all I ask you to do is ask law enforcement people in the southwestern Oregon counties if there's a crisis. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, and people that are listening, there is. And it's not going to get any better without a permanent solution. Thank you for your time, and thank you for letting me go over.
Thank you very much, Dave. Appreciate you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gil Riddell. I'm here to actually introduce two organizations which I represent, the Association of Oregon Counties and the Council of Forest Trustland Counties, and I'm hoping the chair will give me maybe 4.5 minutes because I'm representing two. Just AOC is different from other groups you will meet because it represents all 36 elected county governments. Counties are teammates with the state in shared delivery of vital services, public services, and public revenues, shared public revenues, and policy development. Counties together represent the same population and land area as does the legislature. In forest policy, AOC is by necessity focused on federal matters. There are 13 national forests covering over 14 million acres in Oregon, and that's one quarter of the state's land mass. There's also, of course, the ONC land you just heard about. AOC is working closely with the National Association of Counties and other stakeholders to draft and support congressional legislation to enable federal agencies through active management on a landscape scale to reduce fuel loads, restore fish and wildlife habitat, and utilize the nation's timber resource to help restore the economic, environmental, and social condition of rural Oregon. AOC praises the Oregon Congressional Delegation for leading the adoption of the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act, a financial lifeline for county governments and schools nationwide. AOC will engage in that effort again, but only if it is part of a long-term active management solution to federal forest management. The Council of Forest Trustland Counties is a subcommittee of AOC that represents 15 Oregon counties that transferred lands to the state since 1936, largely under the 1939 Acquisition Act and its amendments. The state bargained with counties for these lands, actively promoting the program with assurances the lands would be rehabilitated, reforested, and protected to produce harvestable forest lands. Various governors and the Board and Department of Forestry characterized this arrangement as a trust, contract, or partnership in which the counties have been fully participating. Today, you recognize these forests as state forests, the Tillamook, the Clatsop, Sun Pass, as an example. 700,000 acres, management and revenue sharing is under ORS Chapter 530, and rulemaking is by the Board and Department of Forestry. CFTLC believes that the primary purpose of these state forest lands, and we believe the history is clear, the primary purpose is for timber production for public revenues and jobs. Nevertheless, counties are working cooperatively as a statutory advisory committee to the Board of Forestry and the State Forester to implement the greatest permanent value rule, which incorporates a range of forest values. One last point, if I may, there's a local share of the gross revenues, which represents less than two-thirds of the gross revenues from timber sale. It goes back to the county of origin and local districts of origin. In the last fiscal year, the county share was $37.4 million. On some 230 million board feet. Compare that with what figure Dave gave you. System-wide, however, it's important to note that 64% of the county share goes to the state school system. Only 28% of the county share stays with the county as general funds. 8% goes to other local taxing districts. Two observations about how this county can, this committee can help. On federal matters, please stay informed and support productive actions in the Congress, which we will undergo, and the federal executive branch. On state force matters, ensure that the state administrative processes and outcomes respect the history of the Acquisition Act and the enormous stake held by local state forest communities. That's about as fast as I can talk, Mr.
Thank you very much, Gil. Great job. Roger, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I've handed out a fact sheet about Oregon Small Woodlands Association, so I won't read through that. I'll let you look at that on your own. I would just like to point out that Oslaw has 17 local chapters representing 23 of the state's 36 counties, and I can guarantee you that we have members in each and every one of your districts. With that, you've asked us to tell you how Oslaw, or what Oslaw does for to advance the economic, environmental, and social issues of Oregon and her citizens. I will read a couple of statements of Oslaw's purpose. It is to provide for a medium for the exchange of ideas about family forest land in collaboration with other family forest owners, public agencies, forestry consultants, timber industry representatives, and other interested parties. And they do that by disseminating information to educate owners of forest land tracts on forest management issues, sustainably manage forests over a wide variety of forest values, grow, harvest, and market forest crops, foster the wise use and protection of forests, and keep members informed about the new and ongoing issues related to the ownership of forest properties in Oregon. So that's what OSWA does. And I will briefly try to keep us on schedule by you asked us also to suggest some ways the committee may help serve our needs and our natural resource interests. I would like to start off by saying, first and foremost, do no harm to the forest sector. That would probably be the best thing you could do as a committee. To do that, I would also like you to act on behalf of the forest sector and take charge of all issues relating to forestry that come before the body. You are the committee charged with that, and I would like you to be leaders in that endeavor. And finally, there is a recent release report on forestry and ag by OFRI on the forest side and Department of Ag on the ag side. I think you should use that as a matrix to judge your decisions and to make your decisions. And your goal should be to make the next report, when it comes out, I think 2 years from now, to be more positive than the current one. That would be mean you fulfilled that role and not doing no harm to the forest industry and the ag industry. I will be back on Tuesday or Thursday to talk about the ag side. Some things, specific agenda ideas from OSWA
would be first to protect the infrastructure of the forestry industry, specifically on the east side. This infrastructure is dangerously close to crumbling or disappearing, and if we allow it to go any further, it may not be there for our members to even have markets for their products. Secondly, bring parity to the fire protection system funding model. You've heard State Forester Doug Decker talk about Senate House Bill 2050. We support that wholeheartedly. Finally, I would like to also have you bring parity towards all sectors of land ownership, specifically between ag and forest land. We have bills to do that, dealing with pole buildings on forest lands, just like ag lands, and license plates for forest land owners, just like ag land owners. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity.
And thank you, Roger, for keeping us on time. A great presentation. Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. Our next panel is going to be Jim Geisinger, Mike Dewey, and Adrian Miller. And folks on deck will be Greg Miller, Paul Cosgrove, and Paul Barnum. Welcome, gentlemen. Good morning. And please proceed. Jim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Geisinger. I represent Associated Oregon Loggers. Our organization represents contract logging companies in the state of Oregon, and we have since 1969. We were the original AOL. We represent about 1,000 companies that are directly or indirectly involved in the contract logging industry. Many of these companies are second, third, and even fourth generation companies. They're predominantly small, family-owned, independent contractors. Our average member employs 6 to 10 people, although we do have members that employ over 100. The one thing they have in common is that they are independent, family-owned businesses. The way we contribute to the economy, and particularly the timber-based economy in Oregon, is we perform the on-the-ground land management activities. We start the process that turns one of our most important raw materials, natural resources, into finished products that people use around the world every single day. And in spite of all the challenges our industry has faced over the last two decades, we are still the number one producer of softwood lumber in the United States of America. And that's the material that is used to build homes. And as the housing market continues to rebound, our contribution and the significance of it to that economic recovery is going to increase, not decrease, in importance. We are the second or perhaps third largest industry in the state of Oregon, behind high tech and running neck and neck with agriculture. And one of the things this committee can do, and I know those of you who serve on the committee understand this, but not everybody in this building does, and that is the significance of our industry to the state of Oregon. A lot of people talk about our industry in the past tense, like we were some colorful part of the state's history, but not a significant factor in its future. Well, the fact is we can be a very, very important factor in the future economy of our state. You get outside the metropolitan areas and you get off the I-5 corridor, and agriculture and natural resources is what drives the state's economy. We're a very agricultural dependent, natural resource dependent state outside of the metropolitan areas. So keeping that in mind as you deliberate and consider proposals that come before you, I think would serve our industry quite well. And I think the last thing I would say is don't forget the past as you consider future decisions, because once you do, it does not put those decisions and the consequences of those decisions in the proper context. The pendulum has moved to the left in a very, very dramatic way over the last 20 years. Compromises have been made, concessions have been made, and when you have people come before you and say, well, it's only another 0.5% or it's only another 5%, remember that the very, very significant compromises have already been made, and consider those in that context. We're here to help you remember the past. I'm a resource you can depend on for the last 35 years, and if you really want to know what happened way, way, way in the past, you can call Fred Van Atter or Dave Barrows. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jim. Good morning, Mike. Welcome.
Good morning. For the record, Mike Dewey, I wear a number of different hats. for this panel. It's International Paper, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. Also, the Oregon Potato Commission, Waste Management, Inc., and Stimson Lumber. So we see a whole plethora of the natural resource issues. So let me, very quickly, for the Commodity Commission's research is extremely important, trade extremely important, and for commodity commissions, they assess themselves, tax themselves for those particular programs. There is some general fund that goes into those also, but clearly they help the state of Oregon economically. For waste management, it is the leading material recovery company in the United States. They were a landfill company. If you're a landfill company, you're not going to be very successful. So you need to divert, and that's what they do, and the recovery is significant. And you may hear from time to time what we're now doing with unwanted plastics. They go into a landfill. They can't be used. They're now made into oil. And it's a very, very interesting process, and we're working through DEQ and permits. For Stimson Lumber, 160-year-old privately held company, they have mills in Tillamook, Forest Grove, and Clatskanie. Andrew Miller and I have talked a number of times about what is essential, and you're not going to hear this very often, but in operating a mill these days, the education of the employees for any mill is significant, because it's all computerized. So you have to be highly successful, and you have to be educated, so take that into consideration as you work through this committee and other committees that you serve on. And then, of course, green energy and biomass is significant, because that's in part how the steam is produced to run a mill. For International Paper, 900 employees make paper bags, corrugated paper, whole bunch of facilities throughout the state of Oregon. And I was with one of the vice presidents recently, and they just purchased some property in Russia. And it's thousands of acres, and they say it's a little difficult doing business in Russia, notwithstanding a lot of markets in that area. And so that's why they are focused in part there. But they have a very, very significant portfolio here. We have a very strong Forest Practices Act. You're going to hear about fire protection in this committee, and others have talked about that. That is very, very significant. I'll leave you with a couple thoughts. One is the consideration of energy prices, because these companies spend a lot of money on energy, and that can make or break at the end of the day whether or not a mill facility is going to work or not. So keep that in mind. And last, in order for us to be successful, and I have 3 seconds, we have to be sustainable and we have to be cost effective. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Adrian, you have traveled a considerable distance to be here today. Welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you very much. Good morning, Chairman Witt and members of the committee. My name is Adrian Miller, and I represent Longview Timber. Briefly about Longview, we were formed in 2007 when a company called Brookfield Asset Management, along with additional investors, bought a long-standing Northwest company called Longview Fiber. After the purchase, the timberlands were separated from the manufacturing side and of the business and were formed into two entities. Longview Timber, which I represent, owns the timberlands, and Longview Fiber Pulp and Packaging, Inc., which owns the manufacturing facilities. While these companies share a long history, they are indeed separate businesses with separate sets of investors. But I won't get offended if you call me a fiber employee. That's quite a compliment. Longview Timber is organized as a real estate investment trust, and we manage 650,000 acres of timberland in Washington, Oregon, split about 50-50 between the two states. Our ownership in Oregon is concentrated in the Northwest in Clatsop and Columbia counties. We also have ownerships east of Portland in Clackamas County, and as far east as Hood River. Our southernmost ownership is actually just east of Salem in our Silver Falls tree farm. As a timberland owner, our business model is relatively simple. We grow, harvest, and then replant trees to support over 120 domestic and international customers. And I should note that 120 number actually represents specific facilities that we ship logs to. So the actual number of total customers, such as Stimson, is actually about 100. Company-wide, we employ approximately 60 employees and support an annual contract base of 300 full-time workers in the state of Oregon. And these are Jim's members. These are our contract loggers, our rock truck drivers, and a variety of other service providers, tree planters as well. As you consider policies before this committee, I would ask that you consider how might they be perceived from the perspective of a timberland investor. And in short, do they discourage or encourage long-term investment? The investors who choose to invest in timberlands are not looking just for annual returns from harvesting trees. They are looking at the underlying asset value that actually grows the trees. Investors have to ask themselves questions such as, will this land be worth more or less in the future? And I would encourage the members of this committee to ask themselves those same kinds of questions as they consider policies before this committee. Investors have choices, and Oregon competes for these investment dollars both within the Pacific Northwest as well as within the United States and throughout the world. Examples of the kinds of policies that may come before your committee this session that would support the long-term investment in forest land include the governor's proposed changes to the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. Also related to wildfire is a proposal that will limit but not eliminate liability for wildfire between timberland owners. These types of policies send signals to timberland owners that in the state of Oregon is not just, they are just not interested in the jobs that annual harvest of timber provides, but that the legislature also values the underlying timberland investment. When Oregon timberland competes successfully for investment, it secures jobs for tree planters, loggers, truckers, foresters, biologists, millwrights, mechanics, even a few lobbyists, longshoremen, all working in Oregon's rural resource economies. And this is one point that if I leave you with anything today that I want you to understand, is that when timberland is highly valued by investors, it attracts the best kind of investors. And the best kind of investors ensure that Oregon's timberland is well maintained, continuing to provide ecosystem services such as clean water, carbon sequestration, wildlife habitat, and recreational opportunities. Because those are values that all Oregonians enjoy, in addition to the jobs and harvested wood products. Whether a company is held by private institutional investors, is publicly traded, or owned by a family for multiple generations, we are all focused on maintaining and increasing the underlying value of our timberland for generations to come. Thank you very much for your time.
Gentlemen, thank you, each and every one of you, very, very much for your very valuable testimony, as well as the jobs that you maintain here in Oregon. Thank you.
So while my colleagues are coming to the dais, I recognize that there's a need for speed. So good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Greg Miller, the Government and Community Relations Manager for Weyerhaeuser Company. I've been with Weyerhaeuser for 18 years and in the forest industry for 36 years here in Oregon. So you asked how we impact the economy, environment, and social impacts for Oregon, or in Oregon, and some Oregon facts for you. We've been operating in the state of Oregon for about 110 years. We have about 980 men and women that work in our on our timberlands and in our facilities. We have four manufacturing facilities in Lebanon, Sweet Home, West Eugene, and Cottage Grove. We own just under a million acres in western Oregon. In 2011, we paid about $8 million in taxes, excluding payroll taxes. And from 2007 through 2011, we made about $2.3 million in charitable contributions here in the state of Oregon. You asked for some suggestions on how you might be able to serve our natural resource and agricultural interests, and I have two suggestions for you. First, I respectfully ask that before you pass any legislation out of this committee, that you seriously assess the potential negative impacts to the cornerstones of Oregon's economy. I think you've heard that theme throughout this morning's panels. I would add that I would hope that you'd use the best set of facts and verifiable science when considering these significant policy changes. We will act in our enlightened self-interest using facts and science as a threshold. We sustainably grow and harvest native tree species like Douglas fir, and they're in worldwide demand. So we're uniquely positioned here in Oregon on the Pacific Rim, and to remain competitive in the global economy, you folks can help us with that.
Secondly, I think you've heard this before. We think that this particular committee is the Assembly's leader in all ag and forestry legislation. We hope that you act as the single point of contact that touches our ag and forestry traded sectors. And then finally, you asked what would be our top legislative goals for this session, and there will be forestry bills before the committee. Weyerhaeuser will be in lockstep with our principal forestry associations, Oregon Forest Industries Council, and Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Put simply, we're in strong support of their legislative positions and activities. And then finally, you asked, I would say that, I would mention in title only, that the following issues are top of mind for Weyerhaeuser this session. Shared forest fire costs, you've heard a little bit about that. Forest fire liability. Green building. I don't think you've heard that word yet said in the committee. Energy policy and forest biomass, herbicide use in forestry, and property taxes. Thank you very much. I'm here available 24/7 at your beck and call. Thank you.
I'm clean up, Paul.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove, representing both the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association and the American Forest and Paper Association. Those are the regional and national trade associations for the industry. And the handout I gave you is produced by AFPA. It has a relatively strong data collection division, and it tries to do that for the industry as a whole, members and non-members. And I'd just like to highlight, in terms of the impact, Jim Geisinger made a good point. All these numbers on this sheet used to be bigger, but they're still significant numbers. Nearly 34,000 people at last count work for this industry on both forestry and the paper side together. I should point out at the bottom of this sheet, the copying sort of cut off. This is a December 2012 updated document, and I'm sorry that they didn't copy terribly well. 34,000 people nearly, about $2 billion, just shy of $2 billion in payroll annually. The value of industry shipments and product on the paper and forestry side is just shy of $8 billion a year, and tax payments just shy of $240 million to local and state government in Oregon. So it is still a very significant industry, and one that is, in fact, the most important industry in many Oregon communities. I'd just like to make one point about rural versus urban. People don't realize in Portland how dependent we are on this forest products industry. A number of these plants, including a lot of the plants that actually produce the paper boxes and the paper bags that you see in your stores and in your facilities, are actually in Metro Portland. It's not just a rural issue, it's a rural and urban issue. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so very, very much. Welcome, Paul Barnum. Welcome to our committee.
Chair White, members of the committee, my name is Paul Barnum, fifth-generation Oregonian, past president of Stop Oregon Litter and Vandalism, past chair of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, the organization of which I am now executive director and have been for the last 4.5 years. OFRI, if you're not familiar, is a state agency. It's governed by a 13-member board appointed by the state forester and funded by a forest products tax. Harvest tax. Our mission is to educate Oregonians about forest management and train forest landowners in sustainable forest practices. OFRI has just published a comprehensive study of the forest sector's economic impact. I've provided you an executive summary there, and knowing that's so you didn't have to read the 200-page report. And then within that, there is a 12-page executive summary with pictures. So I commend that to you. I won't take the time to go through that. Actually, a lot of people who have been talking this morning have been using the facts and data that we actually reported in this report. Later this week, you'll receive a copy of this pocket-sized 2013 Oregon Forest Facts and Figures. This is being mailed to all legislators here in Oregon, as well as our congressional delegation. The Oregonian, when I met with them, this was several years ago when I was chair, basically came to the conclusion that OFRI is the honest broker of credible information about the forest sector. And so we are not a lobbying organization. We are an educational organization. I hope that this committee and others in the legislature will turn to OFRI as a source of facts and data about the forest sector when you need facts and data. As well, to Chair Witt and Chair Brad was on the board of OFRI, so he understands well how it works. If you have ideas on how we can better educate Oregonians or better educate forest landowners, we hope you'll take the time to share those ideas with me. I would just conclude by, there are some recommendations in there. Some of those have already been talked about, federal forests and the Forest Practices Act and all of that. So take time to read those. But let me just say, you know, the forest sector is a vital contributor to Oregon's economy. It brings wealth to the entire state, and it's a fundamental livelihood in rural communities. Oregon is simply a great place to grow wood, probably one of the two or three best places in the world, and we should be taking advantage of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, gentlemen. Wonderful job, and thank you for keeping us on time. Next, please, I call up first of our fisheries panel, Kurt Melcher, Bruce Pauley, and George Okulich, please. And on deck will be Tim Bernasek, Jim Markey, and Jim Myron. Welcome, gentlemen. Good morning.
Thanks.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I've been with the department for 26 years now, and I'm a longtime Oregonian native. Have a great appreciation for the fish and wildlife resources of the state. I know we're really short on time. I'm going to talk very quickly, and I do recognize that I also have some time before you on Thursday on the wildlife issues, so we can get into some of the additional details there. I did want to mention first that I am a resource for you all, as well as all the members of the legislative body. I'm happy to come over here at any time to meet with you on any given issue, to, whether it's a constituent issue or a legislative issue. So please be sure to use me as that resource. And I'm the principal agency contact for legislative issues. We will bring in other individuals on for topic matter experts at times, depending on what the issue is. But I'm the primary legislative coordinator here for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'll just touch very briefly. I'm going to get done before 3 minutes if I can, just for the sake of time. But I want to touch very briefly on the economics of fishing and hunting and wildlife viewing in Oregon. The economics of these activities are often overlooked. We have done a number of studies, both with the federal U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well as with Travel Oregon, and partnered on a study 4 years ago to look at travel-related expenditures in the state. Statewide, annually, fishing, hunting, and wildlife viewing travel accounts for over $1 billion in expenditures. Those occur across the state in all counties, and as you might imagine, many of the rural counties, well over 50% of their travel-related expenditures in the counties are related to fishing, hunting, or wildlife viewing. It is an important economic engine. Additionally, there's another $1.5 billion annually in expenditures on fishing and hunting-related equipment. So it is a big business. The Fish and Wildlife Commission manages fish and wildlife species based on a number of statutes. We have a whole book of them, in fact, but the two principal overarching statutes are the Food Fish Management Policy and the Wildlife Policy. And then lastly, I would mention that the commercial fishing industry in Oregon is also an important piece of the coastal economy. In 2011, for instance, ex-vessel revenues, that is revenue just as the products cross the dock, does not include any value added through processing, retailing, wholesaling. Ex-vessel revenue was $146 million. It was actually a bright spot in the 2011 economy when you look at across sectors. It was actually a high point in our recent history. So with that, Mr. Chair, I talked quickly, and I recognize I have some time on Thursday with you as well. So
thank you very much. Bruce, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Pauley from Sherwood, Oregon. I'm a volunteer with the Coastal Conservation Association of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today regarding the concerns of our organization and our legislative agenda for this term. CCA is dedicated to the conservation and enhancement of our vital marine and anadromous fish resources in Oregon and 17 other coastal states. CCA Oregon has strived to shift the focus of fisheries management in Oregon from maximum harvest to sustainability. We have been involved in efforts to protect wild endangered fish, reform harvest limits and methods, improve efficacy of hatchery production, management of predators, and keep available well-maintained and sustainable fisheries in Oregon. Recently, fisheries management in the Columbia River was reformed in both Oregon and Washington to transition away from the use of non-selective gill nets in the main stem of the Columbia River. This policy announced by Governor Kitzhaber last August began a process of policy meetings by agency staff and stakeholders in both Oregon and Washington that manage the Columbia River fisheries jointly. CCA thanks Governor Kitzhaber for his leadership as well as the agencies and stakeholders in both states for the formation and implementation of these new policies. We endorse these reforms as a total package and ask that you would help protect these historic changes. We would also ask that you resist efforts to alter or change them in the legislature. CCA has worked with the legislature and this committee to pass laws to help reduce the impact of marine mammals, specifically sea lions, on salmon, steelhead, and sturgeon in the Willamette River. We would encourage more efforts to work within the existing federal laws to protect fish from unnatural predation. There is major concern over the status of white sturgeon in the Columbia River. Sea lions are taking a serious toll on breeder-sized sturgeon at Bonneville Dam in particular. Many of these important brooders are 50 to 60 years old and cannot be readily replaced once lost. We would encourage any efforts at state or federal levels to help address this serious conservation problem. Avian predation on juvenile salmonids has been identified as a major issue regarding rebuilding and restoring of our salmon and steelhead populations on the Columbia River and every other fish-bearing river in the state. We have been aware of efforts championed by Representative Krieger and others to improve management of avian and other predators. We encourage steps to help improve survival of our juvenile salmon and steelhead all over the state. Regarding marine reserves, CCA was an active stakeholder during the OPAC process and worked with Senator Johnson and others to pass legislation limiting the size and scope of marine reserves in Oregon's nearshore waters. There are currently 5 marine reserve sites in Oregon, and we will be monitoring the work plans and funding of these sites to be sure the site boards that were agreed to stay in place. We would ask that those issues before your committee, that you would adhere to the agreements made with the stakeholders and limit the size, scope, and duration of these sites. CCA continues to work along with ODFW as a stakeholder in fisheries issues all over the state, including the current coastal multi-species salmonid plan that is still in process. Protection of wild fish is possible alongside modernized hatchery and broodstock production to meet the needs of harvest. We would ask that you support mitigation hatcheries as well as improve efficacy of hatchery production. In summation, CCA is eager to work with ODFW, Governor Kitzhaber, and the Oregon Legislature to help restore and enhance Oregon's vital fisheries resources and encourage sustainable selective fisheries that protect our wild fish, native stocks, while providing reasonable harvest levels and practices that will assure fish for future generations.
Thank you very, very much, Bruce. Great statement. George, good morning and welcome.
Chair Witt, good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George Okulich, here on behalf of the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, also known as NSIA. NSIA was founded in 1993 and is dedicated to the preservation, restoration, and enhancement of sports fisheries. NSIA represents about 300 sports-related businesses, large and small, across the Northwest. They include businesses that manufacture tackle, rods and reels, like Lionel Glass, Akuma. They include businesses that buy and sell, such as Cabela's, Fisherman's Marine, Fred Meyer's. They include magazines that promote and advertise, such as Salmon Trout Steelheader. They include some guides, boat builders, and I presented a packet to you, and I've included a list of some of the other businesses in that packet. We bring an economic message to the table. We're not a sports club. We are an industry lobby group that represents the business interests of the many members and the families who depend on sport fishing for their livelihoods. As Kurt said, sport fishing in the Northwest is a $3 billion a year industry, roughly $1 billion a year industry in Oregon. And to provide some perspective, in 2011 alone, according to data by ODF&W, it was estimated that over 11,000 jobs in Oregon were somehow affiliated with sports fishing. In 2011, there was over $680 million in retail sales. And this week, right now, up in Portland, is the Sportsman Show. It's the largest sports show west of the Mississippi. NSIA's vision is that Oregon and the Northwest can be the sport fishing capital of the nation. Sort of the diversity of opportunities, quality of the fisheries, and infrastructure are attractions make Oregon a world-class destination. With this, Oregon stands to benefit enormously with increases in tourism and reducing the amount of participation that's exported to Canada, Alaska, and other points on the map. One of the things we've always talked about is, you know, people can come, they visit Mount Hood, they visit the beaches, they visit our wine, and they can get a few days of sport fishing in. And these are, you know, one of the complaints the guides have made sometimes is that we sometimes lose them to Alaska and other places. NSIA views the governor and the legislature as a government partner. We will continue to work on making sure the agency is fully funded so they can satisfy their conservation mission and help grow sport fishing opportunities, provide management necessary so that fish and wildlife succeed in Oregon. I'll just kind of wrap up because I know we're short on time. Our agenda includes expanding sports fishing opportunities, protecting the sensitive runs of salmon steelhead, continuing to support the governor's plan on the Columbia River, working collaboratively with ODF&W, Tourism, and the Marine Board. And we stand ready to help in any way we can.
George, thank you very, very much. Gentlemen, appreciate your statements. Thank you for coming today, and we look forward to hearing from you more during the session. With that, I'm going to call up Tim Bernasek, Jim Marquis, and Jim Myron. On deck, finishing up, will be Bob Olson, Joe Rollator, and Dennis Ritchie.
Again, in the interest of time, Mr. Chair,
thank you,
members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim Bernasek. I'm here today representing the Recreational Fishing Alliance. The RFA is a grassroots organization representing recreational fishermen and recreational fishing industry on marine fishing issues. RFA's mission is to safeguard the interests of saltwater anglers and to ensure the long-term sustainability of Oregon's saltwater fisheries. Recently, we've been very active in the marine reserves process that was discussed earlier and in the marine renewable energy siting issues along the Oregon coast. The bottom line is the fishing industry has been a dominant coastal industry for generations, but that industry has struggled in recent decades, as has the coastal economy. And the coastal economy depends on a healthy fishing industry, and RFA is proud of its work for both recreational interests and with commercial interests and to advocate for more and sustainable fishing opportunities for Oregonians. Mr. Chair, you asked about what this committee could do for the RFA, and as mentioned, obviously looking at expanding fishing areas along the coast is important, but frankly, we'd be happy to get out of this session with no additional restrictions on fishing opportunities. As important as some people would say the marine reserve issue and the energy siting issues are, the bottom line is they've resulted in fewer fishing opportunities for our fishing industry, and we've got to balance those interests with the interests of our fishing interests as well. So we look forward to working with you. We very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and from John Holloway to Walter Chuck and other members of our association that many of you know, there's just a wealth of opportunity, wealth of wisdom from these folks that have been living the industry for so long, and I look forward to working with you and with our members to make sure that those interests and those resources are available to you. They really are phenomenal individuals with a lot of information and knowledge, and we hope that you'll take advantage of that this session.
Tim, thank you. We'll look forward to it as well. Thank you so much. Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Marquis, here today, proud to represent a group called Salmon for All. Salmon for All is a organization whose membership depends on commercial fishing interests in the Columbia River. We have, between Oregon and Washington, about 550...
Actually, could you use that microphone?
Okay, we'll try this one. Between Oregon and Washington, the two states have about 550 gillnet permits issued to folks who fish in the Columbia River utilizing gillnets and a more modern version of a gillnet called a tangle net, which was implemented by our fishery folks, bringing about a lower mortality rate on salmon, particularly in the spring. Our folks provide many, many rural jobs to Oregon, particularly in the northwest corner of the state, and our legislative goal here will be to preserve those jobs and hopefully enhance them through sustainable commercial fisheries within the Columbia region. So we'll be around talking to you about those fisheries. We have tried to work with the governor's office regarding his new plan for the Columbia River, and we think some aspects of that plan are rather short-sighted and misguided, and will result in something less than an equitable sharing of the resource as is required under the statutes in a directive to Fish and Wildlife. So we'll be talking to you about those issues, and hopefully we can ask you to help us maintain sustainable commercial fisheries in the Columbia Basin.
Thank you very, very much. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
My apologies.
Chair Witt, members, my name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. I've been around this building since the 89 session lobbying on fish and water issues, particularly in a variety of capacities. And the Native Fish Society is one of my clients. They are a native wild fish conservation organization. They're not a fishing club or fishing group. And they focus on the protection and restoration of naturally spawning wild salmon and steelhead, particularly, as well as trout. In my attached my written testimony is a little piece on what we call our River Steward Program. It's a system of volunteers throughout the Pacific Northwest. We've got about 60 river stewards now, and they work at the local level on a variety of different fish-related issues. So we provide support to that or to those folks. This particular committee has an interesting agenda ahead of it this session, dealing with both fish and water issues. And at the heart, Jim Brown did a better job than I can about talking about sustainability, but if we could actually get to the point someday where we're sustaining our naturally spawning wild fish to the point where we can actually begin harvesting them again, then we would consider that to be a successful conclusion. A few objectives that we would like to see some focus on are hatcheries, harvest, and habitat. In the hatchery arena, we'd like to see eventually no hatchery fish spawning in the wild with wild fish. And in harvest, we want to see harvests that actually support the recovery of wild fish. And with habitat, manage habitat so that if there's an optimum capacity for wild fish to spawn and restore. At the close of my comments, I've got three particular bills that we will be providing support for this session, three House bills. We will support bills that obviously go along with our mission, and we will have problems with those that don't. So, thank you.
Thank you very, very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your comments and look forward to hearing more from you during the session. Committee members recognize that some of you may have other business that you need to attend to. It is my intention to finish this last panel, and those of you who are able to stay, the chair would be most appreciative of your assistance. Thank you very much. Welcome and good morning, gentlemen. Please decide among yourselves the order in which you'll proceed, and
since I'm the oldest, I'll start.
All right.
My name is Joe Rollator. I represent folks that fish for a living. I represent the Oregon Aquaculture Society. We grow trout for replanting in lakes and ponds, and we sell trout to ODF&W for people to catch. I also represent McKinsey River Guides Association, which is the largest guiding group in Oregon. There are about 1,000 registered guides in Oregon, and they have a income of about $28 million a year. I also represent the Ocean Commodity Commissions. I don't represent the folks that fish in the Columbia. You've already heard from them. I represent the Dungeness Crab Commission, the Salmon Commission, the Albacore Commission, and the Trawl or Pink Shrimp commission. And you've heard from Kurt that our expressive value is about $150 million a year. We more than double that, bringing in income to Oregon by fishing in other places. Guides do the same thing. Many of us fish in Alaska. Many of the commercial fishermen fish in Alaska. And just to be short about this, you asked me what were the most important things for us. The most important thing for my whole industry is infrastructure. As Representative McCallum said, we need things like docks and dredging and ice plants. We also need things like boat ramps. And also public access to the water for fishing. Predators are a really big issue for us. Predators, both avian predators like cormorants and seals and sea lions, eat fish that are migrating out into the ocean. I know there are a lot of other predators out in the ocean, but those are things that we can probably do something about in the fresh water. And hatcheries are very important to my clients. About 80% of the fish, salmon, steelhead, and trout that are harvested in Oregon come from hatcheries. Private hatchery industry in Oregon sells about $5 million worth of trout a year. The government hatchery system is about $30 million a year. And we need to improve that hatchery system, but we also need to keep it functioning. And thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Joe. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Witt, committee members, Bob Olson with Association of Northwest Steelheaders. We have over 1,300 members and 12 chapters. Central to our mission is supporting and enhancing fish and habitat. You've already heard about the significant economic and social benefits that fishing and related activities provide in our community, and we will continue to talk about that as particular bills come up and during the session. Our organization has been supporting sports fishing for over 50 years. One of our first efforts was to legislatively work to make steelhead a game fish. And we have kept the name, but have gone on to a number of other issues and a variety of conservation-related activities and projects. We like to remind people, whether they fish or not, that our watersheds are special places that need our constant attention. And another area we want to work with your committee on involves maintaining adequate programs and funding for key natural resource agencies, which, as you know, is becoming more and more of a challenge, and agencies like ODFW and others will places that we need to keep supporting and work on. You have a copy of our current magazine. It's for the sports fishing and outdoor show that's starting on Wednesday, and it contains some detailed information on a number of issues, past and future. If you haven't been to one of those shows, I'd urge you to go, because that will give you a first-hand impression of all the businesses and work that go on there. I just wanted to mention a few of the issues that are in the materials that will be in play this session. The governor's directive to take gill nets off the main stem of the Columbia River is a historic effort, and we look forward to seeing that advance and create additional sports fishing opportunity. There's also activity on increasing regulation over suction dredge mining, and a number of legislators and groups are involved in that, and we would hope that that would get some time and attention. Representative Krieger and others have kind of led the effort to help on fish predation, and we support that and look forward to the efforts that are especially right now directed at the cormorant problems. And There's also in House Bill 2697 are ideas for improving the nutrition levels that will be provided in streams for our fish. We are also very supportive, Mr. Chairman, of your efforts to keep working on the woody debris issue and the importance of regulating there. We appreciate that, too. So those are some of the key things I wanted to mention, and we are committed to informing and engaging anglers in important public policy questions. Thank you for providing this really good forum for all of us.
Thank you, Bob, very, very much. Mr. Ritchie, welcome. My apologies, sir, for the late invitation to our committee, but we are most appreciative of your appearance.
Better late than never, and there's both a blessing and a curse for being last, so I'll make this short, pun intended. Oregon Anglers is an all-volunteer group that we started because many individual anglers and independent fishing clubs from Astoria to Gold Beach, from Cascades to the coast, felt like they had no voice. We also started a group called OARS, Oregon Anglers Research Society. That is a 501c3 that concentrates on finding funding for good research projects in the fisheries area that, you know, money is tight. And there are a lot of good research projects out there that aren't being done because they can't get the money to do them. I'm here representing all those fishermen. I'm going to skip all the part about the board members and what I personally done, but right now I am involved as the sports fishing representative, the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. I have been there since its start, and I've served 2 years as chair there. The stuff, the research and the projects that are going on there are incredible, slowly getting to the eventual goal of finding the difference, if there is a difference, between hatchery and wild fish, and narrowing that difference. Now that ODFW has actually changed its breeding regimen and used a lot of wild fish for broodstock, there is a very small percentage in the success of the wild fish and the hatchery fish coming back to spawn. It's in some cases less than 2% difference. I really appreciate Representative Krieger's getting together the Avian Task Force and Mr. Rollator. We're making progress there. I also sit on the Sea Lion Task Force on the Columbia River. As you know, that is always interesting. Our meetings are always picketed. And we're hoping now to hear from the feds because they've been working on delisting the stellar sea lions, the ones that we couldn't touch, and the ones that have become the biggest problem, and they are the ones wiping out our sturgeon population in both the Willamette and the Columbia. That population is crashing and really affecting fishing income of many, many guides. The Oregon Hatchery Fish Research Center has contracted with the Army Corps of Engineers now to produce a surrogate wild Chinook. That's interesting. A surrogate wild Chinook in the hatchery because they need them for mortality counts when they migrate from above the dams in the Willamette, and NOAA would not give them a permit to take any of the wild fish to test, so we have to produce an artificial wild fish and that's exactly what we've been intending to do right from the beginning. I'm just saying, now we've got the money to go forward with it, with the big project, and it's being worked on as we speak. Dr. David Noakes, the lead scientist, has expressed an interest in coming down and talking to you at any time that you so wish. He's an incredible person, and if you haven't visited the Oregon Hatchery Research Center and you get a chance, do. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Dennis. Appreciate your testimonies, gentlemen. Thank you for coming today and sharing this. Committee members, I truly appreciate your patience and your staying on to listen to these these stories. We have many stories to be told about the impacts that ag and natural resources have for our state economically, socially, and environmentally. I fully intend to get those stories out so that we have a better appreciation for what the practitioners in this field actually do and stand for. With that, our committee stands adjourned, and I greatly appreciate it.